Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, with the growling microphone stand in the background, obviously. That's very good. That's us.
There we go.
There we go. Yeah, that's now that. We've got them all worked up and properly done. First, our disclosure, The Personal Wealth Coach is not just your average run-of-the-mill radio program. It is also an SEC-registered investment advisor located in Salado, Texas. One of the greater mysteries of the world is how can it be both a radio program and an investment advisor.
Maybe a little egotistical to say it's one of the greater mysteries of the world. I think it may be a very, very minor mystery in somebody's bygone memory of some moment of time.
Hey, in
somewhere.
My world.
Right.
In our world, it's a major mystery of the universe. How can these two things exist? How can these two identities
exist simultaneously? Think tanks are thinking on just this problem.
You know, I used to ride around in a tank very regularly.
Did you have a think tank?
I was thinking while I was doing that. So I was thinking that, you know, maybe I was the commander of a think tank. Matter of fact, I had a whole, to use the term loosely, troop of think tanks.
Hmm.
Well, not that's it. It's true. I had a troop of think tanks.
Well, I've been around the Central Texas region quite a bit.
And
I know if you have a think tank, which is a tank of people that are thinking, and we're in the financial world, mm-hmm. we're in economics mm-hmm. and the stock market, and you have a stock tank, you would think that...
Well, no, a lot of people have stock tanks out here, right?
Right. There's a lot of stock tanks around here, and I think that must mean that there are a lot of people thinking really hard about stocks.
Well, not that and the fact that obviously it takes an investment to create a stock tank.
Right. Generally, it's a hole in the ground. It's a pool. Yes, you pool the investment. That's what it is.
And probably should be recognized and regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. However, they don't recognize them as securities.
Hmm.
But they're very volatile in that in the summertime, sometimes they completely evaporate.
Right, yeah. Right, and so. I think there should be some regulations
I think we need an academic study on that. Do you think we could fund it somewhere?
I bet if we applied for grants from the government, we might be able to get, I don't know, as little as $300 or $400 million to cover the study.
Well, actually, I think you, since you know so much about it, should apply for a government grant
right.
to try to find the $500 million worth of bitcoins that were stolen from
Mt. Gox,
G-O-X, which, you know, I think... You know, there's something wrong. G-O-X, Gox.
Yeah, Goxia.
It's kind of like Madoff.
Do you want... I realize that you
we,
have
we
some...
We probably ought to give the telephone.
Yeah, let's give that. And we'll talk about that, because I think there's a lot of confusion
in that area. I think you're probably going to add to it.
Yeah.
The more we know about bitcoins, the more confusing they get.
Or less.
If today is the 1st of March... 2014. Now, if it's not the 1st of March 2014, then you're out of luck because you'd have to call back in time to get us. So if it is the 1st of March 2014, we are live and in living color, and the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Yes.
So on to Bitcoins.
On to the $700 million worth of Bitcoins.
Did you say 4.7 hundred million?
Yes, it's like $470 million.
Right, but is it 4.700 or is it
4.700 million.
Right.
I mean, we
it's a big number.
But this is, of course, it's interesting, and that's down 50% from its high in December.
All right, what is
then
a Bitcoin? Let's start at the
then
beginning.
Then it would have been almost $1 billion worth of Bitcoins had they stolen them in December. Maybe they did steal them in December.
People talk about Bitcoins like they are the newest fashion or how this is the currency that's going to take over or any number of other things. Let me begin by saying, what the heck is a Bitcoin? Let's go back a little bit. A Bitcoin, it's called a cryptocurrency. It was developed by an unknown person at an unknown time, which fits the crypto side of that quite well.
You got it. Probably by the CIA.
basically, what it's saying is that in some forms of encryption, there's only a certain number of numbers that are possible to be used as keys.
There is a number of numbers.
Yes.
This is, see, I told you.
It's getting confusing already.
Right.
They have to fit a certain criteria, an algorithmic criteria.
A certain number?
Uh-huh.
My understanding is that there are computers that are trying to find more of these numbers, so the number of numbers is uncertain.
Well, see, here's where we're going to get even more unconfused. I'm using air quotes around the word un. Because now we're talking about a limitation on infinity, which mathematically is possible.
In Congress, there are no limitations on infinity.
well, just as a thought experiment, we cannot encapsulate it in our mind, but if you have...
So we're back to think tanks.
Yeah, oh yes, we're back to stock tank think tanks. If you have infinity and you cut it in half...
You still have infinity.
You still have infinity, but this second infinity is smaller than the first infinity.
I'm not sure of that at all.
Well, that's the mathematical concept here.
Okay.
Basically, the concept of a Bitcoin is in order to have any kind of really good encryption, you have to have a key on both sides.
In my pocket.
This actually goes back to the Cryptonomicon that was written by Wilkinson. In the mid-1600s.
Does that have anything to do with Krypton?
No, that's Superman.
Okay.
We've got a different...
All right.
Different...
Good. Just checking.
So Wilkinson, who was an Englishman specifically, who was a great friend of Isaac Newton, developed, because the 30 Years' War was going around, and people needed a good way of sending letters to each other without having people read them and understand them, he wrote a book on all the ways to do this. The problem with the book is that if anybody else had a copy of the book, they could figure out any of the codes that you wrote in that book. So he put some concepts together by using other numbers, and Leibniz, who was the other inventor of calculus. I realize we're going way back in history here.
And you said this was going to simplify things?
He came up with this idea of using random numbers as the keys, except that he realized that there's no such thing as a random number.
Oh, boy.
So if you think about...
People are zigzagging in the fog on the highway.
The machine that the Germans used in World War II, the Enigma machine, is based on Leibniz's work in the 1600s.
Folks, just in case you're wondering, if you're listening right now, this guy who's sitting over here next to me wearing plaid as usual while I wear plain is smart.
He's
smarter than I am, and I'm the guy who taught him stuff.
So coming forward to today, basically we're still using a technology on encryption that was developed in the mid-1600s, which isn't that big a deal because we're still using calculus as well. It was developed at the same time period.
Which nobody still understands.
Right. Nobody really understands that still. Basically, what those big computers out there that are trying to make more bitcoins are doing is they're calculating algorithms, and the easiest way to explain this is if you think of prime numbers.
Does that have anything to do with Al Gore?
No. No, the WWW doesn't mean George W. Bush either, but algorithms. Okay. I mean, it could. There could be a similarity
look,
there.
Look, he invented the internet,
right? So a Bitcoin basically takes advantage of. If you think of prime numbers, how many prime numbers are there? Well, there's less than the total number of numbers, but there's an infinite number of prime numbers. Similar things are true about the algorithm around bitcoins. There's an infinite number of them, but it's less than all numbers.
You have now proved to me that you're smarter than I am.
Okay. Here's the problem with the Bitcoin. As soon as the Bitcoin is used, or people know that key, the number, that special number, it becomes worthless because the use of that number is just like that Cryptonomicon book. If you know what the book says, you can decode this supposed to be super secure thing.
But the book is really, really expensive today because it's out of print.
Right. It's not been in print for quite a few hundred years.
So you'd have to pay a really high fee to figure out what it says.
Right. Okay. So
basically,
a Bitcoin, if you know the number, even if you own it, it becomes worthless. If two people know the number of the Bitcoin, it is no longer a Bitcoin. It's not money anymore.
And you've now confused the issue to the point of saying, how do we know that it's a real number if you don't know what the number is?
Exactly.
How do you know that it's a real Bitcoin?
This is one of the problems, and this is one of the issues that has been plaguing Bitcoins over the last several months.
It's a Bitcoin plague.
Right. There is a plague of Bitcoins because people have been able to sell Bitcoins to other people that weren't really Bitcoins.
And this is something I want to emphasize here to take a little bit of the intellectual veracity out of this.
It's silliness.
If you look in magazines or online or whatever with an article about Bitcoins, there inevitably, well, at least in my experience, there inevitably will be a picture of this stack of coins with a line through it.
They don't have a picture. They're a number.
Bitcoins are invisible.
They're a number, and if you ever see the number, then the number is worthless. It's not a Bitcoin anymore. It's kind of like the question of, what do you call a forgotten memory? It's not a memory anymore because it's been forgotten.
There is a word for it.
What is
it? It's a three-letter word, which means it's really powerful.
Oh, really?
H-U-H.
Huh?
Huh?
Exactly. That's what Bitcoins are. Bitcoins take the idea of rationality and throw it out the window a little bit.
That's why I don't understand them. We got a lot of calls, and I had a lot of people asking me back in December and January about Bitcoins and whether they should invest in Bitcoin. And if you want to go back and listen to our podcast on one of them someplace, I answered somebody who called in, and if I recall correctly, and I said, you know, in 5 years, we're going to look back and we're going to, if you say, well, what do you think about Bitcoins? And somebody's going to say, huh? Because they won't even remember what a Bitcoin was. And it is, for whatever it's worth, the value of Bitcoins has fallen about 50% since January.
Let me take this a step further. The new encryption techniques that are beginning to come into phase, quantum computing is happening, there's a lot of stuff going on, completely rewrite that book from the 1600s into something that is far more complex, which means that the encryption techniques and unencryption techniques of the future mean that Bitcoins have a very limited life expectancy. We're talking about maybe at the very most, if technology moves very slowly, we're talking about 5 years before they're all completely worthless anyway. How's that for you?
That makes sense. There's a lesson in what's happened to Bitcoins. As a matter of fact, there was one publicly traded company, I don't remember which one it was, Fortress? Anyway, just reported a rather substantial loss because they had invested $20 million in Bitcoins, and I think they reported an $8 million loss without losing any of the Bitcoins. started 2013.
Ancient history.
Well, anyway, the value of Bitcoin soared above $1,100 in December, and it's down to about late Friday it was $549.
But the fluctuation in the price can be $200 or $300 in a day.
Yeah, and so this is, there's something here, though. This sounds like something esoteric that a bunch of weird geeks, and the biggest one being in Japan, an American who was running a Japanese company that was the number one Bitcoin exchange. Boy, it gets sillier and sillier.
The other
sillier.
Two major exchanges already knew about the weakness that caused so did this exchange that caused the people to be able to break in and steal. Basically,
let me get to the point here. Here is a critical thing for anybody who's listening who would like to not lose their money to be aware of. If you invest your money in something that you can't lay your hands on, I want to emphasize this, that you can't lay your hands on and hold or touch, it needs to be backed in some way by the United States government.
Even if it's just regulatorily backed.
Well, that's what I mean, backed in some way. For example, let's say you bought, and I'm not at all recommending you invest in individual stocks, but let's say you had bought IBM or AT&T or whatever stock you want to fill in there, and you hold it, you don't hold it, it's existing in a stock exchange firm. There is an organization called the SIPC, which is chartered by the United States government, and implicitly, or unimplicitly at least, backed by that government, that says if the brokerage firm that's holding your stock, because you're not holding it, it's sitting there in what's called street name, it's in the XYZ, it might be in Merrill Lynch doesn't actually exist anymore, I don't know, some Schwab or wherever, and you've got it there, the SIPC, and if you look down at the bottom, if you ever get it, well, you don't get statements anymore, but it's on your electronic thing. Somewhere down at the bottom of something, it will say SIPC. And when it says SIPC, that means if Schwab all of a sudden goes kerplunk,
those stocks will belong to you still.
Presuming that you have an account that's, what, is it $250,000 or $500,000?
I think it's $250,000. I can check
$250,000. Anyway. But the bottom line to it is that unless you have a really, 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 really big account there, the SIPC will replace the stock. Now, they don't insure the value of the stock. It can rise and fall on the open market. But they will replace it if through fraud or malfeasance or whatever, your shares that are at that company vanish. For example, recently there have been some brokerage firms that have gone kerplunk.
$500,000.
Okay, it's at $500,000. I knew it used to be $250,000.
$250,000 for cash.
Yeah,
it's $500,000 okay. Per customer.
But, you know, a while back, there have been several major brokerage firms, I say major, pretty good-sized brokerage firms, one headed by a former governor of New Jersey, that suddenly went kerplunk and said, we're bankrupt. If you had stocks there, and because they had SIPC coverage, last time I looked at that particular firm, and I can't remember the name of the firm off the top of my head, they have so far successfully replaced about 98% of the value. You know, even, oddly enough, even some of Madoff's stuff was replaced right by that because it was technically under SIPC.
This is fascinating. The end loss expectation for Madoff's thefts may actually be negative. They may actually be able to recover everything.
Here's the point. If you go to a company or a firm, no matter how legitimate you believe they are, no matter how good their salespeople are, the first question is, if you ask a question, if this company where I am depositing my money, where I am buying a contract, where I am buying stock, and I'm not going to have it in my hand, if it goes under, if because of fraud or malfeasance or somebody hacks into their system and takes all their money, which we just discovered can be done fairly easily.
I don't know about fairly easily, but it can be done.
Well, I mean, the point is somebody did it, which means that it is within the realm of doing, and as opposed to when's the last time you heard of somebody breaking into the vaults of the Federal Reserve? It just doesn't happen.
Right.
So it's not.
I saw a movie about that.
Yeah, you saw a movie about it. But the
Bruce Willis was involved.
The factuality is that just doesn't happen. So you need to ask the question, who's insuring it? And by the way, if you hear that something like a state insurance guarantee fund covers it,
it's not the federal government.
Bolt for the door. I don't have an axe to grind on this thing because we don't sell stuff. I can say that historically, the only guarantor for your investments, unless you have them in your hand, that is valuable is the institution, and our government is an institution, is the institution that can create money. Bottom line, the big financial crisis we went through in 2008 and 2009 was because a lot of people were convinced they had completely safe investments, many of which, again, related to insurance. They were completely convinced they were safe because they were backed by an implicit guarantee of a AAA-rated You can go into this thing all day long, but the bottom line to it is
throw in crypto something. Just use the word crypto, and that's what they're talking about.
And so the bottom line is that unless the investment you make is protected against the collapse of the people who hold it, the organization that holds it, by an entity that can create money out of whole cloth. I mean, just here's the money. You are at risk. And the more money you put into something that is at risk, that you can't put in your hot little hand.
How do you know it's hot?
You're dead if it's not.
Well, it's kind of warm.
But it's warm. But this is one of those principles of finance that we just sometimes don't get at all. We think, well, the government may collapse, or no. If the government collapses, all bets are off.
If the government, this is great, and we've got so much historical context here that it is impossible to ignore it. If the government collapses, all the investments in that country are worthless anyway.
Yeah, because they're all denominated in, for instance, in the United States, if the government collapses, everything we have is denominated in dollars. There's nothing left. I mean, all bets are off at that point. So it really comes down to the fact that if we look at where the guarantee comes from, and I'm going to specifically talk about fixed annuities and indexed annuities here again because they're a prime example, but there's other areas where it works the same way. Municipal bonds with AAA rated because of the insurance company that is insuring them. It really comes down to something that's very, very simple. In many cases, the company rating and insuring an investment has a vested interest in selling the investment. The rating companies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, all these guys who were rating the derivatives that blew up were being paid by the people who issued them to give the ratings. That's what we call in the investment advisory business a conflict of interest. And it is, generally speaking, great. An undisclosed conflict of interest.
You know, if I go to the bank and they want a credit report, and I go to their credit reporting agency and I just give them a bunch of money, why should that influence what my credit score is?
Of course not. But it's one of those principles that people don't get because they love the word guaranteed.
Yeah.
We tend to be much more concerned about risk than we are about return.
And sometimes we just hear one word and we suspend our entire sense of disbelief by saying, "Oh, I like that word. It makes me feel good. Guaranteed."
A little fast thinking there. But, you know, Will Rogers said it very, very well. In the Great Depression, people were not so concerned about return on their money as they were return of their money. And that's the point. We will have another Great Depression.
Yep. Going to happen.
Or Great Recession or something.
Probably not going to happen anytime very soon, but it will happen. And we don't know that it's not going to happen anytime soon.
I really suspect if we follow the patterns of history, and for better or worse, we do tend to follow these patterns. Again,
Mark Twain, it's great there. History doesn't repeat itself, but it sure rhymes.
Yeah, and the issue is that if history does rhyme, and I think it does, sometime in about 15 years from now, we're going to have another financial crisis, and it's going to be a doozy. It's probably going to be bigger than the one that occurred in 2008 and 2009, and we will probably screw it up. Now, there's no guarantee that that's going to happen, because we do get smart as we get older, and some people are studying history.
Hopefully we get smart. Some of us get smarter
hopefully
anyway.
Hopefully 15 years from now we'll have somebody really smart like Ben Bernanke who is in position to do something. On the other hand, we could wind up with a ultra-conservative right-wing Herbert Hoover. And
they do the wrong thing.
The head of the Federal Reserve, also being very, very fiscally conservative people and really believing in free market forces. And as a result, when the market crashes and everything starts falling apart, they start raising interest rates, which is what they did in 1929.
I have a quick statement here.
Okay.
People in charge of the Federal Reserve should not have a political axe to grind one way or the other. They shouldn't be liberal and they shouldn't be conservative. They should be studying history.
So they should be computers.
You know? Well, yeah, I mean, as much as possible.
Somebody's got to
maybe one day we'll have a computer do it.
I don't know.
Did you see the movie Her?
Yeah, no, I haven't, but I want to. The point and the key point here again, if you make a long-term investment, look at very carefully what is protecting it, not against market fluctuations. Those are going to happen.
Even bankruptcy of the company itself,
right.
The stock-owned company, that's not going to stop happening.
So the issue is, look at who, if the company that you're trusting your money to, or companies, were to suddenly get hacked and have all their money gone tomorrow. And believe me, that is in the realm of possibility.
Just look at what happened to Target and how much money they've had to spend. It's mm-hmm. It's affected their revenue, the amount of money they've had to spend on security and on paying for the damage that was done in the hack during the holiday season.
You see, in mutual funds, for example, let's just say that you owned a mutual fund and you owned it directly from the fund company. You may not realize it, but the shares that you own there are under the protection of the Investment Company Act of 1940. The federal government says even if the mutual fund company goes kerplunk,
which is the technical term.
Which is a technical term for
right.
they are insolvent,
right.
ran
I think
out
that's
of money.
That's written into the law. In the event of firm going kerplunk,
yes.
sorry about using these technical words.
Right, and if they did that, your shares would still be there. Now, very fortunately for everybody concerned, since the Investment Company Act of 40 was passed, there haven't actually been any companies formally go kerplunk. They actually
that
get folded
mutual
into something
fund companies,
else.
Yes.
And the reason that happens is because everybody concerned realizes the creditors of this company, let's just, you know, I'm not saying, believe me, I want to emphasize here, I'm not saying anything about PIMCO, but a lot of people are familiar with PIMCO because a lot have been going on there. There's a lot of internal something happening there. A big fight apparently at the top, and,
right.
and the CEO suddenly leaves.
He's a former Yale endowment guy.
There's something going on there. But let's just say that PIMCO was discovered to have in the company itself.
We could actually use one where we know of scandals that took place rather
What's
than
that?
Using one that may or may not. Well, let's go to Gabelli. Right after 9/11, Gabelli Funds had a lot of members of their staff die during 9/11.
Uh-huh.
The person that was running the whole company had to be replaced because he was no longer around by his brother, the founder, but he hadn't been in business doing that for several years.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in, he hires a bunch of people, new managers, he's trying to replace people. It's
right.
a very emotional time period. Some of the first massive scandals after 9/11 had to do, and this is several years later, but it had to do with aftermarket trading of mutual funds.
Yeah.
This was Gabelli. Gabelli still exists. The fund assets that
right.
belonged to the investors still exist.
And there's a very crucial point here. The share value of the fund, of the Gabelli, any Gabelli fund, was not affected by the scandals that hit Gabelli because it's priced based on the underlying securities on the open
right.
market.
It owns a bunch of stocks. It isn't
right.
based on the good word of the manager. It's based mm-hmm. on the actual value of the underlying investment.
Now, had you owned stock in Gabelli, which is was traded on the
you
New York
would have lost
stock
a lot of money at that
it,
point.
It collapsed, but the mutual fund did not. They followed the market, yes, but the what we call non-systemic risk that's associated with any company wasn't there. Now, there's two kinds of risk that you really need to be concerned about when you're doing investing.
Yes.
Systemic and non-systemic. Non-systemic risk, a prime example is, had you been investing heavily, if you'd been an employee of Enron, one
Enron,
of the people that had...
And 401k, all your assets in Enron
yeah,
stock.
Then you were heavily exposed to what we call non-systemic risk because the system, meaning the stock market and the government, just kept right on going. But Enron vanished. Your value in your Enron stock just vanished. And, of course, another aspect about having a 401k, as wonderful as they are, is the company itself has control of the 401k, and they shut down the 401k, the ability. Now, there have been a lot of lawsuits as to whether this was intentional or just a coincidence.
Doesn't look like it was intentional.
But it's beside the point. If you had a 401k full of Enron stock,
you couldn't trade it for 6 months because they were changing trustees and of the management.
You couldn't sell it. On the other hand, if you had mutual funds in that same
401k,
mix,
yeah,
they just kept on doing what they did in the market, and they were not affected by the fact that particular bunch of mutual funds was controlled by Enron.
Well, this is one of the things that we say regularly, and this is why we say it. If you're working for a company and you have a 401k at that company, you should not, unless they mandatorily require it, have stock in the company in your retirement fund. Not because you don't believe in the company, but because you're already dependent on that company for your income. They're giving you something for the future. If you make yourself ultra-dependent on that company, and in the end, you don't have control over the direction of that company, you've just taken on a lot of risk that you didn't need to do. And we've got some commercials to play.
We do.
Getting late in the hour.
Yeah, and we got a lot of stuff to talk. Stuff.
Yeah, technical words.
Technical words. Well, we are, meanwhile, going to play these commercials from Town Square's sponsors and KTEM sponsors and so on, but you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And if on the other side of the commercials you'd actually like to call us and ask us a question or something or make a statement, 773-1400 is the number in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within
and
the sounds of our voices.
There's a very high probability that we will be back after these commercials.
Very high probability.
Yes. We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We were having a great conversation during the break, and I just let the bagpipes play for a while as
wonderful.
We just kept on going.
And it's great because our conversations in the studio, we have headsets on, so our volumes tend to get quite high, particularly when we don't have a microphone. And when the microphones are turned on, it's very easy. We can hear our voices. And
otherwise, we start yelling at each other.
Yes, people think, what are they doing in there?
I don't know, but it must be entirely too much fun or something.
Funded.
Okay. Any rate, let's see what we have. That was it? Was that it for commercials?
Is that all the commercials?
Yeah, that's all the commercials.
Did you play two sets?
No, I just played one.
Wow.
But it doesn't look like there's any more. So, yeah, there's only one set of commercials. That's, I don't know what that means about the economy. Last night, he may actually show up for the show. I asked him if he had time to come by today. But last night, I had a very interesting conversation with an attorney. I started to say gentleman, but he is an attorney. Well, maybe he's a gentleman too. For the county court at law number one in Bell County. And we don't do endorsements very often of any kind. But and I'm doing this as an individual. This is Jeff. And I'm doing this as an individual. Kenneth Volka is, in my opinion, the person that should be selected for that court. And the reason I say that is county court at law number one is where probate issues are heard. And that's where the estates and trusts and things of that ilk are dealt with. And Mr. Volka has been working in that area for decades as an attorney. He's litigated extensively as an attorney in that area. He is his opponent is and he are both deep-rooted people here. As far as I can tell, they're both good people. It's just that his depth of experience and knowledge about the probate code and his experience in litigating probate issues, I think, is critical. And you may not think so. I don't know. But if there's ever a deal with a trust or a will, it's that area of law is pretty arcane, to say the least. Its roots go back a long ways, and it is really, really important to have a good, deeply qualified. Ed Johnson was there for many years. He was, and one of the things that I had a great deal of confidence when I would advise people on their wills and trusts, and when somebody dies, I had a great deal of confidence that there was a person actually sitting there on the court who had a great deal of common sense, as well as being an attorney and a great deal of experience in dealing with.
Wait a minute, you're saying that not all attorneys have common sense?
That is a given.
I'm not sure that you should be so inflammatory against these.
Well, you know.
Otherwise, well thought of profession.
The attorneys are who they are, and we pay them to get out there and take a side and be nasty, and a lot of them do that, and that's what they do, and that's fine. However, on that court, compassion is critical. An ability to look through and see the intent of a person who is, for example, unconscious in a hospital, and this person has to be, his affairs have to be dealt with, to look through and see the intent and to make some serious judgments that Solomon might quail at. So Ken Valka is, I am well convinced at this point, is the person for that particular slot. I don't have any endorsements for any of the other slots. There's 22 people or something running for the something or not. I will endorse Jimmy Don Acock, though. Since no one is running against him, I feel
that's an easy endorsement.
But I like him anyway. But for United States Senator, for example, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's 8 people running for United States Senator. There's 4 people running for Lieutenant Governor. This is exciting, folks. Do your research, is all I got to say. 8 people who want to go be the United States Senator. That's interesting. The senator that's running is not being endorsed by the other one, even though he says he likes him. So,
interesting.
There's a lot of weirdness there, and now we're getting into politics. But in the judge's bench, I think it's not a matter of what the political standing or party or anything else is, although in Bell County, let there be no question, the Republican primary is generally who's going to be there. That is the election here, folks, okay? And at the state level, it's pretty much the same thing. The election is over with the Republican primary, although
the governor's race, which actually there's 11 point difference between the two. So the Democrat is 11 points behind, according to the most recent poll.
11 points behind which candidate?
This is
Abbott,
and Abbott has a 90% probability of winning the Republican primary.
Well, that makes sense. One of the things that we all probably ought to be aware of is the fact that sometime in the next 15 years, remember, 15 years is an interesting horizon for a lot of things, the whole party issue may switch again.
Right. And people are already noticing that. The Tea Party is looking at the Republican Party and saying they're not taking enough control of government. And basically, if you look at the concept of the Tea Party based on small government, but then you look at the social issues of the Tea Party based on large government, there's a problem there. That's something that is...
I don't even want to go there.
And you can look over on the other end to the occupiers of Wall Street, that extreme group that says they were also basically say get rid of corporations, except when you look at what funding went to the Occupy movement and how it was spent, you'll find a lot of mismanagement of money there. So it's like the further extreme you get, I don't want to get too far.
I don't want to go there. I mean, it's just, it. I'm tired of it, actually.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people are, too.
I definitely am.
In addition to the fact that $500 million worth of bitcoins that are invisible that nobody's ever seen disappeared.
Yes. And the way that happened, by the way, is they just found a way, a little bit of lag in the system where you click on an order and the computer says, is this a good order or a bad order? And if you clicked again really fast, like within a computer doing the clicking rather than the person clicking, you could overrun the system.
So it's a hyperclick?
It was a very, very hyperclick.
Okay.
You could overrun the system, and the system would say, oh, it must be good, and just send out all the money. And that's what happened, only it wasn't really money. It was bitcoins. So these bitcoins got sent out to basically a bunch of people in a big network of computers out there that were hijacked by hackers,
yep.
And then those computers sent the bitcoins on to somebody else. And the nature of bitcoins is you can't look at them, so it's really, really hard to tell if they're on what computer.
Somebody asked me a little while back, why is a bitcoin not as good as the dollar? Very simply, the government of the United States of America, which has a really, really big bunch of power in every aspect of many, many things, has the government and the Federal Reserve have the unrestricted ability to back the dollar.
This is even more, because this is part of the things that the U.S. government have regulated. Mm. The accounting of where your money is started on paper. It is now electronic, but that accounting system has so many people checking and rechecking each step along the way, the system is a lot slower than it should be. And when people talk about, you know, I'm trying to get a wire from someone to get from one bank to another, and it says it's going to take three days to do it. We've got the technology. Why is it taking 3 days? This is why it's taking three days, because we want to make sure that it's done properly. Bitcoins move at such small, infinitesimally small fractions of a second from one place to another, and that's the weakness that was just
used. And let me give you an example. Let's say you have let's use another example, because we deal with this regularly. Let's say you have an account at we use Pershing. Since it's not available for the public to use, we can talk about them. As an investment advisor, we use them as a custodian. And let's just say one of our clients says, hey, we need some money, and there's cash sitting in the account, and we transfer it to their bank. It typically takes a couple of days to do that. That transfer goes through the Federal Reserve, literally, through the Federal Reserve's computer.
It's called the Federal Reserve wire.
Well, either that or what are they called? EFT, electronic funds transfer, even if you don't use a wire transfer, which is a bit old-fashioned because that was telegraph.
We use Morse code.
We do.
Right. No, we don't.
I used to know a guy named Morse, and I could never understand what he was saying. but the point is that it takes a little while to happen, because it goes through the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve checks it back and forth, and then it comes here. Here's the thing about dollars, the nice thing, wonderful thing about dollars. You mess with the dollar, and there are guys who carry guns who will come looking for you, okay? And when they find you, they will put you in an unpleasant place wearing an orange jumpsuit with unpleasant people for an extended period of time.
It's a gated community.
If you mess with bitcoins, well, you've messed with the bitcoins. They have any?
They can sue you.
Well, they can sue you, but the point is, first
they have to find out who you are first.
They got to find out who you are. They got to figure out if you actually broke a law, because the question is, and this was a question that's been raised in this $470 million. That's why I say disappear. Was it technically a theft? And this is the point the lawyers are already arguing. And if it is, was it under Japanese law?
American law
or international law?
This is really interesting. The whole concept of the Bitcoin is based on secrecy. So we don't even know who it was that supposedly owned the Bitcoins that had the money or the Bitcoin stolen from them. The whole that goes to another point. If there is a bank robbery, whether physical or electronic, you've got your money at the bank and the bank is robbed, we don't even think for a moment that that money's going to come out of our pocket. If the bank gets robbed, we're insured.
Right.
We're like, that's not even a big deal. I would, you know, yeah. We kind of think of the concept of a bank robbery as almost a romantic thing. If you watch the movies, they're always yelling, I'm not even taking your money. You're insured. The government's going to pay. We take that for granted.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, by the way, true. And I'm not, let's just say that you were using Lehman Brothers as your stockbroker, and you had a $200,000 or $400,000 account at Lehman Brothers the day it went bankrupt. Guess what?
You got your money.
You got your money. You got your shares. No problem.
Do you know how rare that is in history?
You know how rare that is in the world?
Right. In history, in the world, that we are one of the few countries. I mean, this is, look what happened to Greece. This wasn't stocks. This was bank deposits. Greece says, oh, man, our debts are pretty bad, and so we're just going to take it out of the banks. Mm-hmm. That your money is now our money. How rare it is that our country doesn't do that. It's a pretty normal practice throughout history, by the way, that the king would just go to the bank and say, I need some money for my war, and you have a lot of gold in your vault. And the bank would say, well, I don't think you're a good bet as far as loaning goes. Tell that to my musketeers, or tell that to my marines, or tell that, you know, they just come in and say, we're taking this.
As Andrew Jackson says, how many regiments does John Marshall have?
Right, exactly. And that is history. That is the reality of the history that has been the reality of the world until we have this very rare system. This thing
that is
so complex, right. and we look at it and we complain about it, the accounting, mm-hmm. and we got to do all these other. This is why we have it, because the people of the United States elect our government, and we say, we like to have trade, we like to be able to invest in things, but we need to make sure that fraud isn't going to stop our entire system, and we need to make sure that the government doesn't have the power to stop the whole system. The government is the people.
Right.
We can't forget that.
And it's the problem that we have in America financially is that we assume that degree of safety for all investments.
Right.
This is where, let me give you another example. If you're investing with the XYZ company or whatever, the whatever company, and you're using them as your investment source or vehicle or whatever you want to use the term here.
How did you know I was using the XYZ company?
And you have what's called a privately managed account. That's the same thing that I was talking about as being concerned about. If the XYZ company fails, and believe me, every major mutual fund company I know of, for example, has privately managed accounts.
Yep. They're called separate accounts or separate funds.
They're not called mutual funds.
No.
And for whatever it's worth, whenever I've looked at one of these and looked at the holdings and taken the time to dig through it, I almost inevitably find, I say almost, so far I've always found, that the privately managed account or separate account has exactly or very nearly exactly the same portfolio as a mutual fund. They just charge more because of the sizzle, because you have a privately managed account.
But there's also, just, I mean, there are some other things that happen.
But
you know, you get to see your tax basis very quickly, very clearly.
Right.
But you can do that in the mutual fund. You can. There's a lot of things that were selling points that aren't so good anymore.
But this is the point. The question, and you need to have this in writing. Don't accept the salesman's word for this. If that company fails, what happens to your money? And in most cases, if it's a privately managed account or a separate account or with an insurance company or whatever, unless the Investment Company Act of 40 is involved there, which in most cases it isn't, except like in variable annuities and things like that, if the company fails, your money goes away and you are an unsecured creditor.
A lot of times there is SIPC coverage. However, the people that use these separate accounts tend to have multiple millions of dollars there, and SIPC covers up to $500,000.
But you have to make sure there's SIPC
right.
coverage, because
so
in many cases, I have seen a lot of cases where separate accounts are not covered by the SIPC because they're actually held by the managing company.
Right.
And we're about out of time.
Yes. If you would like to contact us off the air, we'll be back next hour.
Off the air? Is that after and
I'm
off?
I'm fasting.
Yes.
No,
okay.
I'm not. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947. And this is a hard one to remember. It's 947-1111.
You can also reach that same voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, tpwc.com, or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can listen to web podcasts, or you can send us messages through the web or whatever you want to do.
Are you going to give your disclosure message there that it may lower your intelligence?
It may, if you listen to our podcast.
Yeah. Okay. We'll be back.
Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.